courses. She teaches English and honors at the University of Toronto and has received fellowships from the National Endowment for the Arts, Mames Arts Commission, and the Yaddo Gerasi Foundations. From 1981 to 97, she was communications coordinator for University of Maine Sea Grant, and in 1998 to 2000, the writer, editor for an engineering firm monitoring Superfund-based cleanup in San Francisco Bay area. She now lives in Orono near the confluence of the Penobscot and Stillwater Rivers. Sounds like a nice place to live. Okay, so if you could give a hand for Kathleen, she will come up and...
Thank you, Hugh, for inviting me. And does anyone here watch Link TV?
Just a few people.
I feel like I'm at a Bioneers conference with lots of energy and all sorts of wonderful things being talked about and discovered about a future that is hopeful and not...
Oh,
I have a big voice.
Well, this is just so funny.
Oh, that.
You don't have a big head.
And the next thing I want to say is that I was very lucky when I was young. In 1965, I took a week-long workshop from the poet Gary Snyder. And 1965, the University of California held a big poetry conference, and people came from all over the country and the world, actually. And Gary gave a week-long workshop for just a few people, which was great. And I've been very influenced by him in my writing, especially earlier on. But I think you'll still kind of hear that influence if you know his work. And at that time, in 1965, he would not have been called, he wasn't called a deep ecology poet. He was called a beat poet, a beat poet. But when we think of a poet and one who's associated with deep ecology, especially from the 1980s and 90s, we think of Gary Snyder. Nowadays, we call ourselves eco-poets, but there is a little bit of a difference between eco-poetics and deep ecology. And with most eco-poets today, we are usually writing about nature in its contact with humans in a destructive way. So most poets in their poems, when they're writing about nature, will see it as just kind of an ecotone, like a place where human destructive behavior comes and meets the natural environment. And we see that in a lot of eco poems. What I'm going to read from is a book called Narrow River to the North. And it was a project that I did several years ago and got a grant for the cost of flights for aerial photography. I was doing aerial photography of the Penobscot watershed, which pretty much got narrowed down to the river. And my idea at first was to take photographs and then write poems from them, but it ended up being kind of a mix of writing poems and finding photographs and back and forth, both on land and from the air. A poem I just wrote recently, and if this book goes out of print, I will make it the preface, is this poem. No Atlantic salmon were harmed in the making of this poem. Or no Atlantic salmon were harmed in the making of this book. Depends on what I do. For years, I've eaten Atlantic salmon once a week, like clockwork, sometimes Alaska salmon, but always American. There's something patriotic in the act of indulging in what's close to home. But we've never eaten salmon from the Penobscot. still endangered, and yet we admire their resilience. Isn't this how it happens? Using their lateral lines, they've invented a way to sense the change in the Earth's magnetic field and remember the river they once lived in. Count me in, they say. Count me among the living. This year, 720 have returned, not enough for a broodstock. But don't think this is an elegy. I've seen insects come back to life after lying comatose for half a day. I've seen a brook trout writhing in a pail until it suddenly leaps out and back into the river, making its escape. Wilderness enters our lives, and we find a way to greet it. Walking beside the river, past the old logging booms, the rotting booms, we hear the salmon navigating, slapping the water like oars. We cheer them on as they pass back and forth through our lives. My partner, who is really the aerial photographer in the family, was this summer when the international, was it international? When the national whitewater canoe races were being held on the newly opened length of the Penobscot River, and he was overhead. And if anyone was there, that was him buzzing overhead and bothering everyone. He was trying to get close enough down, but there are rules. You can't go down too far. And but then after that race, there were a number of races along the rivers. And I remember not being in the race, but standing and watching from a little dock on a river, on the Stillwater as it goes around Marsh Island. And we were all jumping up and down and rooting, and somebody said, "Look, it's a salmon." And right then and there, the canoes were going by with their oars, so that's where that image came from. I also want to say that there are two saints of the Penobscot River presently who have done so much, and you've already heard from one of them, Sherry Mitchell, and after me, you're going to hear from the other, Maria Gerard. And I just want to thank them both for everything they've done. And I loved, I forget who it was who brought it up in the responses, about can people be indigenous who have lived in a place for a long time when you weren't the first people, when you weren't the first people there? When do we come to a place? I've lived here from 77, and I've lived along the river for most of that time. And at the opening of the river into the bay at Stockton Springs, and to me it feels like home. So, a lot of these follow a style, which is something that Basho invented way back when in the 17th century, and they're called haibuns. And the first part is a little bit of prose, and then underneath it is a haiku-type poem underneath it. During the time when I was writing these, 2007 or 8, there was a big flood on the Penobscot River, and the Milford area was particularly interesting. There was water everywhere, and the trees were standing in the water. It was very impressive. The water taking shape. It's not the currents in the river, but the river in the currents. At the mouth of the river, and the photograph is of the new bridge, what I used to call the Hancock Waldo County Bridge. It's not called that anymore. At the mouth of the river, I am suspended, walking on water. At the bottom of the river, thinking curved space makes rocks look rubber. The eyes of the salmon see heat, see movements from above. My eyes, however, care about color, not heat. My heart is in the water. They are carving me into a shape now, maybe a boat, and now I am licking a frozen stone. This is how the river is thawed from its cryogenic state, born from the eater of granite. the blur of canyons, ravines, ledges of obstinate boulders we push our weight against but cannot budge. Water rose in a body of murky browns and green algae on the morning of an endless tide. In the beginning, a stone garden of crescendos, the muscular skill of the scraping of ice, the melody unrehearsed, the lunar risings, slow adagio, forced into the narrows, you carve your sinuous windings. We drive Route 2 to witness the ravages of the flood. So many trees are swamped by the rising water, we gradually forget they are trees. They begin to be blurs or a strange new species that evolves only in times of crises to survive us all. The trees in the river, first you see them, then you don't. And this poem starts out with a very long line and then it goes and gets smaller and smaller. That's kind of a rant. Over 8,500 miles of rivers and streams in the watershed, flowing, rising, surging, draining, damming, clogging, icing, evaporating, rolling, transporting, irrigating, silting, flushing, absorbing, roiling, pulsing, receding, merging, rippling, falling, heedlessly. May 1st, opening day for salmon season on the Penobscot, the first since 1999, catch and release only. Fishermen caught some grass, a couple of sticks, a hunk of styrofoam, a child's lawn chair. Nobody spotted a house drift by, but they'd heard that one had slipped off its moorings near Frenchville and was on its way downstream. You never know what the river will release. Even in the narrowest flows or standing pools, the river demands to be heard. From roads, I learn a landscape, a stretch of straight black highway on either side, a stand of spruce and Norway pine. Mist falls on the beauty strip, hiding the swath of clear cut. And looks like one more. since somebody was talking about the scientific names of things being Latin and that they don't really have a place. One of the great things that Thoreau did on his three trips to Maine was to go along with the Penobscot Indian, and every night as they were nodding off, he would cross-examine his guide and get all these wonderful Penobscot names of all the species of the biota. So I'll read this. Wanting to know the names of trees. Early morning in late October, I was wearing the forest green jacket when I caught up with you. You were the expert, and I wanted answers. A century and a half of deforestation, brief recovery in the 1850s, followed by fever pitch 20th century. Maine lost 96,000 acres of timberland between the 1990s and 2006. 41,000 acres reduced to houses and box stores. We made a sharp turn into deeper woods. Hush, Joe Paulus dressing a deerskin, Thoreau beside him under the night sky, wanting to know the names of stars, of trees. Wait, I had to go further north for something.